Good to be back. I think some of the most dearest and some of the sweetest people I know in the whole world are right here. It's good to be here. Got some fine Christian folks on vacation, but it's good to be back among those we know here tonight. Junior doesn't know this, but because Russell sang that extra song, he got off the hook because I was going to ask him to sing one. So now he can breathe a sigh of relief till next week. And that's a warning, see. That now he has time to get all prepared. I haven't heard him sing for a while. I think that'd be good. I'm sure he would be more than willing to cooperate. I hope you took some time today to look over 2 Samuel 12, 13, 14, 15, all the way through 18. It'll help a little bit. Maybe to digest this morning's sermon and this evening's. It's been a good day. It's been a day full of activity. Seems like when you're full of activity or pressed for time a little bit, that's when things seem to go wrong from time to time. Makes it a little hard to deal with it. I rushed home after service. Well, I didn't rush right home. Rushed over and told Diane to get something for me to eat, and I came back to the office for a while. And then I rushed over to eat, and I gobbled down my dinner real quick, and I rushed into the bathroom to get cleaned up before coming back to church. And Diane, being the sweet, lovable, kind wife that she is, had brought me home a Susie Q along with the chicken. Now, that's one of my weaknesses. By the way, I read where the guy who invented Hostess Twinkies died this past week. There was a big thing in USA Today about that, and mentioned in that article about the lawyer's defense used out in California for this guy who had murdered someone. He said that eating this junk food, Twinkies, had caused him to have a mental deficiency. I've decided as a pastor now, anytime I do anything stupid, I'm going to blame it on Susie Q's. It's not my fault, it's the Susie Q's. But anyway, Brittany wanted half, and I gave her half, and I rushed in the bathroom. And a minute later, I hear Brittany coming, and she's coming in with this awfulest gob of Susie Q filling on her hands you've ever seen. And before I can say a word, she takes a swipe at me with it. And I'm saying, no, 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 don't do that. And she looks up at me so calm and says, oh, Daddy, it won't hurt. It's just a little icing or something. You know, it wasn't a big deal to her. You know, settle down, calm down a little bit. That was the essence of what she was trying to say. I get along quite well if she spills her milk or something like that. I've kind of learned to adjust, you know. You just expect that out of kids, so when it happens, you just think anything of it. Just clean it up, and no use getting all excited. But somehow, in the bathroom, when you're in a hurry with your dark suit on, and here comes a kid with Susie Q, I mean, it's a little different story. I tended to respond a little differently. We all have those built-in responses, unfortunately. You don't have to think about what you're going to do, how you're going to respond if you crack your head, or if you stub your toe, or if you hit your thumb with a hammer, do you? The response is immediate. By the way, you know, Dad used to do some carpentry. I helped him a lot, and I used to hit my thumb a lot. And I guess that's probably why I'm no good at that today. I still would hit my thumb, probably. And I tried to learn that when I hit my thumb, not to respond negatively. Now, that's hard to do, I tell you. And you've got to make up your mind ahead of time. You say, I'm gonna hammer these nails, and sooner or later, one of those nails is going to be out of place, and my thumb is going to be right where it ought to be, and I'm going to hit my thumb. And when that happens, I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to say, and that's it. You got to make up your mind ahead of time. That's the way you're going to respond. It's the same way with any problem or anything that we would term a trial or a tribulation. As I said this morning, the problems of life just have a way of just hitting you in the face when you least expect it and knocking you down, and they just floor you. Perhaps it's a bill that comes in the mail or a letter or some other thing, some health difficulty or something that just arises, some financial problem that just pops up out of the blue And what are you going to do with it? What's your response? You've got to be ready if you're going to respond right. You cannot control the circumstances. No one can. But you can control your response to the circumstance. And if our response is going to be right to those things that come into life that cause us problems and difficulty and pain, then we're going to have to be prepared for them. How will you respond? How do you respond? Well, when we come to Psalm 4, I think we can identify here three possible responses to adversity. Now, David was just hit out of the blue with this thing. I mean, he was taken in completely by Absalom and his treachery, and finally by his request to go and worship, and he let him go. He had no thought of a rebellion. And then, boom, the next thing he knows, he is fleeing for his life. And everyone is against him and the whole nation, it seems, but that handful that goes with him. What was his response? Well, we saw it this morning in Psalm 3. David didn't respond in fear, although that might have been an initial reaction. At any rate, he moved from that to a position of faith, trust in God. And we talked this morning about moving from fear to faith. As we come to Psalm 4, we find that most probably this psalm comes out of that same situation. The historical context is the same. And here we find David once again reviewing the same responses that for us that we found in Psalm 3. But going beyond that, and speaking to some responses of some other people around about him, some of those who fled with him. And so within Psalm 4, we can find at least three possible responses to adversity. I think they are instructive. I think they're worth looking at tonight. Because chances are, when we're hit in the face with that problem, we're going to respond in one of these three ways. Now, two of these ways are negative. The first is positive. And so we'll look at it first. Quite convenient that it's at the first of the psalm, so that'll work real well. In verses 1 to 3, we see one response. That is the response of trust. Trust. That means confidently and patiently waiting on God to act. That was David's response. It's the essence of all that he said in Psalm 3. Psalm 3 is called a morning psalm because it's mentioned there about awaking. Psalm 4 is called an evening psalm because later on in the psalm, David speaks about going to sleep at night. It is possible that Psalm 3 was penned when he woke up after finally crossing the Jordan and getting some sleep, and Psalm 4 on the next day before he went to bed. And so he is already in a position where he's trusting God, but he has had time to observe the responses of the other people that are with him. David's response is trust. Let's look at it first, verses 1 to 3. He says, "Hear me, when I call, God of my righteousness. Thou hast enlarged me when I was in distress. Have mercy upon me and hear my prayer. O ye sons of men," now he addresses Absalom and all those that have rebelled, "O ye sons of men, how long will ye turn my glory into shame? How long will ye love vanity and seek after falsehood?" Selah. "But know that the Lord has set apart him who is godly for himself. The Lord will hear when I call unto him." David has full confidence, full trust in the Lord. He said, "Listen, how long are you fellas going to oppose me and seek after vanity? The Lord's going to hear my prayer. I'm going to be vindicated. You're on the wrong side of this thing." Now that was a powerful statement for a man who had run for his life and ran all night and was in the desert with a few hundred men when the whole nation was going to rise up against him and chase him. But David trusted God. We can see why he was able to trust God here in verses 1 to 3. And first of all, I just want to mention that he is able to trust God for the same reason that he was able to trust him as we saw in Psalm 3. Because he could reflect or think back or remember what God had already done for him in the past. He says, "Hear me when I call, O God of my righteousness. Thou hast enlarged me when I was in distress." Now the word enlarged means literally to give more room. And it's an expression to, in a sense, in saying that God gave him an opportunity to be free. God allowed him to escape his enemies. He says, "Thou hast enlarged me when I was in distress." And the word distress means pushed into a tight space or squeezed into a corner where there's no way of escape. When he was in that situation before, God allowed him to escape. I remember, at least it comes to my mind, the time when David was in the cave. Remember, hiding with a few men in a cave, and Saul and all of his army is after him. This is before he became king. It's in 1 Samuel. And Saul comes into the cave, and David's hiding there. Remember that instance? Now, that was being in a tight place. God saw him through. It was all like that, all the way through the latter part of 1 Samuel, as he fled for his life, him and his mighty men, and Saul pursued him over and over again. God was able to see him through. And he reflects on that now. We saw that this morning. God enlarged me when I was in distress. But not only is he able to have trust in God because of his reflection on the past, but also because of God's character. He begins by saying, "Hear me when I call, O God of my righteousness." In other words, God is a righteous, just God. He knows that what Absalom and all the people are doing is unjust, and that God is righteous and God will make it right. So his trust is based on God's character. As he goes on, in verse 1, he says, "Have mercy upon me." And the Hebrew phrase here, "have mercy," is just very, very close to the New Testament idea of grace. It means, "Show me favor, even though I'm undeserving, Lord. I know that you're a gracious God, and your favor is going to come to me." You're a just, righteous God, but you're also a merciful one, a gracious one. And he knows God. He knows God intimately, and God's character enables him to trust God in this situation. I might also say that his relationship, God's relationship, that is, to his people, is another reason why David is able to trust him. He says in verse 3, "But know that the Lord hath set apart him who is godly for himself." And here I believe David has in mind the relationship between the godly person and his God. There is a close relationship that is developed between David and God. David is called the man after God's own heart. He had a close fellowship with God, and he knew God intimately, and he knows that he, being in God's will, is set apart by God. He is in a special place. And this relationship is another thing he looks to, which enables him to have that trust. I cannot help but remember Job in the book of Job, chapter 1 and verse 21. After Job loses all of his family, except his wife. And by the way, if you remember, we preached on that not too long ago. I believe that was by Satan's design that his wife was left. You remember her advice a little later on? It's interesting. Satan took everything but the wife. Why? Because she added to his problems. It didn't help him any. But he's lost everything but his wife. He's lost all his possessions, all of his children. And even later on, a little later on, he loses his very health. And he is good as a dead man, having an incurable disease. But at this point, in Job 1:26, you remember that famous phrase, Job says, "Naked came I out of the womb," or, you know, "Naked came I of the world, and I'm going to go back the same way." He said, "The Lord giveth, and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." What a statement of trust. What an explicit trust that confidence in God, that God always does right, and I'm going to trust Him and have faith in Him and serve Him no matter what, no matter how bad it seems. David's in a bad situation. David has lost everything. He's lost his kingdom. He has lost, in a sense, his family in Absalom. He has lost his possessions. He has lost his very life in one sense. He is not a free man. He's a fugitive. But he's able to trust God. Being able to trust God when everything goes wrong is not something that is a natural nor an easy response. It's the supernatural response. It's the response of a spiritual person. It's a response that comes about because this person has seen the fire before. I remember back when I was a freshman in high school playing baseball. And I didn't start on the varsity team, but I got in a game every now and then. Whenever we'd get 10 runs ahead, coach put me in. I guess he felt real confident about putting me in that situation. I remember the first or second time he put me in the game, some big high school boy threw me a curveball. I never hit against anybody who could throw a curveball before. I'm standing there, and here's this thing coming right smack in my head. Now, always before, when someone threw a ball in my head, I tended to get out of the way of it. You know, I didn't want to get hit. So when I seen this ball coming in my head, I got out of the way. The first thing I knew, that thing went right over the plate. Steer right. I said, I always knew people could throw curveballs, but I didn't know they could throw curveballs that well. And he proceeded to continue throwing me curveballs. I think I struck out or popped up. I don't know what I did, but it wasn't good. So I went back, and the next time we had practice, put the pitcher out there to throw in batting practice. But they always threw fastballs, straight balls. And I said, he threw me a couple, and I said, hey, I knew this guy on our team threw a pretty good curveball. I said, don't throw me anything but a curveball. That's what I can't hit. Throw me a curveball. So I made him throw me curveballs every pitch until I learned to hit it. I learned it when it was up here. It wasn't going to hit me. It's going to be down here in a minute. And it's the same way when it comes to the problems of life. You might say when life throws you a curveball, when it looks like you're going to be down and out for the count, just be patient. You know, that's easy to say. It's easy to say. Trust God. Just like it's easy to say, now you just stand there, it's not going to hit you. It's easy to say, but you can't do that of yourself. You need God's help. And more than that, in our feeble state of affairs, we need some practice. That's why God doesn't hit us with a knockout blow first. As we grow older, and as we marry, and as we raise our families, it seems to me, at least in my case, I can't point to anything scripture, but it seems to me that God doesn't, at least not in my life, He didn't hit me with the worst of things to begin with. Just a little problem here, a little problem there. And pretty soon down the road, after you've had some practice, you're able to deal with those bigger problems. That's the way it was with David. He'd been on the run before. It wasn't such a big problem to him because he had learned to trust God. You say, I want to trust God when the problems come, but I have difficulty. You're not the only one. Everybody does. But the next time a problem comes, you'll have less difficulty. Be where you ought to be. So be patient. Let God have His way in your life. Learn to trust Him in the little things and then even in times of great difficulty. One particular response to adversity is trust. David is an example of that. But David has observed the others that are with him. And so he is able to point out for us and to them two other responses that are not quite as good. Another response to adversity is anger. Verses 4 and 5. Anger. Now as we read verse 4, it doesn't really come across. It says, stand in awe and sin not. Commune with your own heart upon your bed and be still. Offer the sacrifices of righteousness and put your trust in the Lord. But the phrase stand in awe is a Hebrew phrase that literally means to tremble, just to shake. And people get upset and shake and tremble in a time of, fear or in a time of grief. Or possibly when they're angry. And so, really we have to fit in by context what is meant here by stand in awe. Does it mean shaking in fear, anger, grief, or something else? Well, I think it's undoubtedly anger. It's being just so mad, you're just shaking all over. It's being out of control. Say, how do you know that? Well, when the Septuagint was translated, which is a Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, which was translated before Christ was born by a lot of Hebrews, a lot of scholars or rabbis who knew Greek and so forth, they translated it this way: be angry and sin not. We find it again in the book of Ephesians in the New Testament, where Paul, alluding to this verse, says in the book of Ephesians in chapter 4 and verse 26, be ye angry and sin not. So I don't have any hesitation in saying that what we have here, this standing in awe, refers to anger. He says, literally, you can be angry, but don't sin. The way Paul said it. He said, be angry, but sin not. You see, you can be angry and not sin. It's not angry. It's not sin to be angry. It wasn't sinful for David or all those that were with him to be angry at Absalom. Absalom had done a terrible, cruel, wicked thing. The sin comes in the wrong handling of anger. God built anger into us as an emotion to equip us and energize us to deal with the problem at hand. But it becomes sin when we direct that energy not to the problem but toward a person. Or when we direct it toward another in revenge or whatever. Let me give you an example. I mentioned this morning, so you ought to be familiar with it without me reading it all. But in 2 Samuel chapter 16, verses 5 through about 11 or 12, we have the story of David fleeing, and this Benjamite, Shimei, is cursing David. And he throws rocks and stuff at him, and here's a whole band, and he's just one man. He is so upset at David, being a descendant of Saul, that he now sees his chance. He sees King David fleeing, and he wants to get back at him. He's cursing David. And in verse 9, one of David's men, Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, says, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over, I pray thee, and take off his head. He was angry. It didn't justify murder. That was a wrong response. Blowing up, trying to inflict pain on another person. David's response was different. He said, let him alone. The Lord's bid him to curse me. He said, just let him alone. He said, even my own son seek him alive. How much more this Benjamite? He says, it may be that the Lord will look on mine affliction, that the Lord will requite me good for this cursing this day. That's what he says in verse 12. No doubt it angered David. David was a man just like you and I, made him mad too. But he didn't sin. Not like Abishai wanted to do. So, be angry and sin not. Now, in the rest of verse 4, he says, commune with your own heart upon your bed and be still. The word commune here means to think. He means, listen, when you lay down tonight, think over your anger, sort it out in your mind, and deal with it. Don't allow it to go on. It's almost equivalent to what, in fact, it is equivalent to what Paul says in Ephesians 4:26, be ye angry and sin not, let not the sun go down on your wrath. Don't allow feelings of anger and resentment to go on from one day to the next. They just get worse. It becomes more of a sin and more of a problem to deal with and harder to deal with. So stand in awe or be angry, but sin not. Instead, think in your heart when you go to bed, deal with it, get it out, confess it as sin, get rid of it. And then he says instead in verse 5, offer sacrifices of righteousness and put your trust in the Lord. One who is trusting is patiently waiting on God to act. One who is angry is asking, why hasn't God done something? You run into people like that all the day. You see, our anger can not only be vented toward other people, vented toward those who are instruments maybe in our suffering or our trials, but it ultimately is directed at God. It's saying, God, why don't you do anything? You're not going to do anything. I'll have to defend myself. I'll have to revenge myself. And it's nothing more than a anger at God. Why don't you do something? The reason God often doesn't do anything is because we haven't learned the lesson that we were supposed to learn when He sent the trial to start with. And the lesson isn't anger. We can respond by trusting God, or we can respond by becoming angry. There's a third response in verses 6 to 8 that David points out. Now he speaks to those who doubt. We can trust God, we can become angry, or we can become a doubter. David says, there are many that say, who will show us any good? No doubt David's heard a lot of people in his band, the Traveling With Him, saying that very thing. Who's going to help us? The whole nations went after Absalom. We're helpless. What can we do? We can trust God and patiently wait for Him to act. We can get mad at God and say, God, why haven't you done something? Or we can just sit around and say, God just can't do anything, or God's not going to do anything. You know, most of us believe God can, but we become doubters when we believe God won't. And we pray and we pray and we pray when the problems come. God, get rid of this, and God, do this, and God, work out this over here. And God doesn't do it, and then we say, God's not going to help me. There's no end to all these problems. There are many that say, who will show us any good? Lord, lift thou up the light of thy countenance upon us. Now, verse 6 in the first part, David's talking about those who are doubting. In the latter part of verse 6, he's again responding himself in trust. And he's asking God to lift up the light of thy countenance upon us. And he goes on and he says in verse 7, thou hast put gladness in my heart, more than in the time that their grain and their wine increased. You see, they fled so quick they didn't even have any food. They didn't take a lot of things with them. Mephibosheth, remember him? Saul's lame son, who was loyal to David, his servant met David outside the city and bought him a lot of food. And he told David that Mephibosheth stayed behind because he wanted to assume the throne. It was a lie. Mephibosheth was not given an opportunity to come. The servant acted treacherously on his own. David found that out later. But this servant, trying to get in good with David, whatever, brings all this food. Why did he bring food? They didn't take time to take enough food. And perhaps by now the food's starting to run out, and everyone's saying, who's going to help us? We're going to go hungry. And David said, I'm more joyful now than when I had a lot to eat. Everybody's running around worrying about starving to death, and David, I can just see him, you know. He sits down, leans back on a rock, props his feet up. I wonder if he thought to bring his harp with him. I can imagine him sitting out there playing himself a little tune, whistling a tune, you know, having a good time. Everybody else is going crazy. Thou hast put gladness in my heart more than in the time that their grain and their wine increased. And now it's late in the day and he's ready to go to bed. He says, I will both lie down in peace and sleep, for thou, Lord, only makest me dwell in safety. God's going to take care of me. I'm just going to be at peace in my mind, go to sleep, and sleep like a baby. Such trust, while everyone else around him was in doubt. I remember a few years ago, a man sitting in my office. He doesn't any longer go to church here. He came in to see me because he said, you know, I just have a lot of doubts about my salvation. I remember when I went to an altar, and I remember what I prayed, I remember all this, but I just don't know if I did it all right. I don't know if I'm saved or not. And I said to him what I often say to someone who says that to me. I said, you know, I have never ever yet run into an unsaved person that doubted their salvation. It's true. If you're not a Christian, you don't have anything to doubt. You don't run around with doubts. Usually it's the man who knows the Lord or experienced something that is able to doubt. But anyway, I went on to talk to him and we was able to identify some areas in his life where he allowed sin to get a hold of him. Nothing great or disastrous or anything that we consider that bad. But I mean, any little shirking responsibility, whatever, is sin. And we were able to identify a few of these things in his life. And I said, you know, when we are in a habit pattern of committing sin, it's no wonder that you doubt. Because when you're that way, you're bound to doubt. Why? Because you don't feel like a Christian. You don't have any fellowship with God. You've lost your fellowship. You need to confess sin, forsake it, get straightened out to regain that feeling of fellowship with God. The Holy Spirit is there and He's convicting your heart. He's not giving you good feelings of fellowship. He's convincing you of your sin. It's no wonder you don't feel saved. In other words, when we as Christians sin, we feel just like an unsaved man. We feel convicted. I said, I'm not going to give you the gospel, and I'm not going to tell you to pray a prayer and receive Christ. I'm going to tell you to go home and think about what we said and confess some sin and tell me how you feel tomorrow. Next day, he had a big smile on his face. He didn't have any doubts any longer. That's the way doubt works. You see, we allow the circumstances, problems to come in. They generate a wrong response, a sinful response. And the first thing you know, we don't feel like God cares about us. We don't feel like we have a relationship with God. We don't feel like we're even saved in some cases. Not a whole lot different than what you find here. Everybody in David's troop was looking around. They look at the circumstances. They look at the problems. David looked beyond the problems and he saw the answer. David didn't see a problem. It's not a problem to me. I'm going to lay down and sleep. I've got perfect peace. In fact, I'm happier than I was when everything was all right. Because he was responding right, not wrong, to the circumstances. Now, when our problems arise, when the trials of life hit us smack in the face and knock us down, we're either going to trust God, we're going to get angry at God and others, or we're going to end up doubting God and ourselves. I suppose if we went through the rest of the Bible, we might find some more responses, but that's at least three we find here. I'm wondering tonight, what's your response? How have you responded to your problems in the past? When adversity enters into your life, what do you do? But more than that, today we need to ask ourselves, what is going to be my response in the future? Because we need to set in our minds what will be our response today and prepare ourselves for it. Or we'll be knocked flat when they come and the response will be wrong. How do you do that? You've got to be prepared. The only way that you can be prepared for each day is by going to the Lord in prayer every morning. You've got to go to the Lord and you've got to say, Lord, I need your grace today. I can't do it by myself. Lord, I want you to give me the ability and the grace to respond rightly. I've been praying in this vein a lot lately in regard to the fruit of the Spirit. I need God's supernatural ability of the Spirit to be able to respond in the way that I should and exhibit the fruit of the Spirit. It's my responsibility. I have to do it. There's nothing wrong about praying for God's grace and help to do it. And having that focus on every day. And if we're able to be a spiritual person and have the fruit of the Spirit in our life, just in the little old problems and upsets of a day's time, and we develop and build into us that right response to wrong or bad circumstances, then when a big problem hits us, we respond the same way because we have practiced. We've learned to hit the curveball. We have developed a right pattern of response. We're ready for it. Until we're ready, there's no doubt whatsoever our response is going to be wrong. It's the way we are. That's how weak, sinful people that we are. It's not easy to respond in trust. We've seen this morning, four steps in Psalm 3 of how to move from fear to faith. It's not easy. Even when we're prepared and we're hit with it, we have got to go through this process in our mind of pouring out our hearts to God and focusing and reflecting upon what He's done for us in the past. And then realizing, relying on His sustaining power day by day in the midst of this trial. And make our prayers for God's will to be done. Not our own. How will you respond in the future?